Accession number 161. Start again. Accession number 16690, Peter Frank, reel 3, followed after a pause by reel 4. Left channel is informant's mic only, right channel, informant and interviewer mixed.
Mr. Frank, reel 3.
Yes, the 13 was really a showcase, so they wanted to show that there was a self-governing body. And because, again, I was connected with these people, and one of them was my relative, my mother and I were protected from transport further onto Auschwitz for a considerable period of time. And I was totally protected at that time, because, of course, I was in the garden producing something for the Germans. Just to get that out of the way, my mother contracted tuberculosis, and because she was ill, because it was reported that she was ill, she was immediately put on the transport to Auschwitz, and that couldn't be stopped. And I knew that she would be transported, and I volunteered. In fact, I had some difficulty in getting into the transport. Now, we knew what to expect, because outside Terezin was a proper concentration camp, the Kleidefestung, which is a small fortress, which had the usual inscription, Arbeit macht frei, and which was full of concentration camp victims. In Terezin, we didn't wear any pyjamas or any other uniform. And because it was a showcase, some cultural events were allowed. There was an orchestra, a fabulous jazz orchestra. There were theater shows, most of them illegal. But of course, once you permit something, you can enlarge it. And there was, compared to a full concentration camp, I have a considerable degree of freedom of movement within the confines of the concentration of the town, so that you could go and visit people. People still lived in the rooms, though perhaps several to one room, many to one room. And I was then asked or made, I can't remember, to move into a unit with youth of my age, and I lived there for 2 years. And of course, what we were up to is nobody's business, because then the idiocy, that was an old barracks as well, or officers' mess or something like that. Our room faced onto the square, which was still performing territory, where all the German high command was, what were the pearl binoculars. Very difficult to find out what they were up to. And you could have the atmosphere of, well, is the situation at the moment reasonably quiet? Can we sort of stretch a point a little bit? Or have we got to really pull our horns in and behave ourselves, because we won't tolerate any nonsense at all? And the youth leader used to go to the high command almost daily. And again, we created a football team that was encouraged. So by a football team, football, competitive football on a league basis. And after a day's work, you can imagine. And we had athletic activities at a designated area that wasn't within the confines of Terezin as such, again, between the fortifications. And so, having access to food, doing physical work, and practicing sport. Once again, I was exceedingly fit, in spite of the fact that I was, I nearly died. I had 3 episodes of hepatitis, and they wrote me off. That's about it. When I was back, I was in general. But I had a sufficient period of time between the last part of hepatitis, and being taken to Auschwitz to get fit again.
How did you come by the binoculars?
Well, it's stolen somewhere. Presumably, I can't remember. I mean, presumably, took them from somebody who was stupid enough to bring them with him in one of those transports. You know, all sorts of things. You know, I had a dagger, a knife, and all well hidden so that when we had these sporadic raids, because somebody did something and they wanted to know whether it was one of us. When I remember we had one very amusing episode, the leader of the chap who was in charge of this quality youth hostel where we all lived, was a chap who was permanently in fear of what might happen. He tried to run a very strict place. It was absolutely impossible. We were all so tarred with all the rushes that if you had said there's a safe break into it, somebody would have known how to do it, not me in particular. And we knew that something was cooking, looking through the windows. And on top of it, we wanted to teach him a lesson because the chap downstairs would make very difficult. So I ran downstairs and told him that one of the boys had just died. And we put him on a bench, gagged him, because he was naughty as well, so we thought we'll sort the whole lot out. Gagged him, tied him so that he couldn't move, covered him with some blankets, and carried the whole thing down to the office, just as the Germans marched in to do a major search. What are you doing? Oh, we got a dead body. I think he died of typhus. We've never seen an evacuation as quick as that.
You knew what the effect would be?
Of course. And, the garden, right in front of the garden, the main room, was a small dwelling, again in the fortifications. There was a very nice lady there, and I'm pretty sure that the head of our garden group, the horticulturalist, had an affair with her. But quite apart from that, of course, she smuggled information, money, goods to us. And the first time she actually came into the garden, she never came to the garden. It was quite a piece of somebody came to control. I spotted Heindel, who was one of the nastiest pieces of work in the whole German hierarchy, outside. Now, I wasn't allowed outside, except with a group in the collective pass. And they were doing something which they didn't want to do. I don't know what happened. And I stormed out and pointed up, beating on my life. But he was so interested in me that he didn't go and check inside. And that was pretty difficult. This tunnel mission. This boy's got to be taught a lesson, you know, blowing off the gun and the whole works. But otherwise, if we had gone in there, she would have been in a concentration camp. And we would have been all deported and it's all cut apart. So it's that sort of quick reaction to situations which allowed you to take risks and which allowed you to survive. I mean, that happened on a daily basis. There was always something. When you went through the checkpoints every day, and it was a routine, but every now and then there was some new form of check. And we always had something on us that we shouldn't have had. And this went for 2.5 years, and I was never, ever caught.
And obviously, knowing the mentality of your captors,
we knew how far you could go and how to create a diversion. I mean, I'm not very good with horses, but I was Paul's deputy in the garden. I think 17 girls, Paul and me, and another bloke who was not a genius. He was interested in worms and things like that, rather than in gardening. And he got caught very early on and was transported further. So then it was just Paul and me. And I was deputy in charge, and Paul was always somewhere gathering information from outside, getting himself a new suit through this woman, and so on. And I had to find ways and means of not only getting stuff through this checkpoint, but also to distribute it once I got in without anybody noticing. Because after all, officially, I was supposed to deliver it at the High Command. Well, very rarely went there, but I had a piece of paper telling me that's where I was going. And the once when I was in difficulty, I had the biggest count I've ever had with two horses doing it. And I had very great difficulty getting the great big classic horses and carting things all their lives. And I wanted to have them go berserk and run away with a whole cart. I had great difficulty in doing so. I succeeded. So straight through a checkpoint, laden with contraband. Things were falling off the cart and people were picking them up and so forth. I mean, there was a lot of comedy in it. I mean, we were dying of fear, but at the same time, when it was over, all you could do was laugh.
You were telling me earlier how you anticipated that the Germans would lose the war, that they couldn't win, but of course there was a possibility that you might not personally survive. Did you ever think that you might not survive yourself?
I thought it was at least a certainty that I wouldn't survive once I was out of Terezin. I had a fairly good chance of surviving till the end of the war, but what I was acutely aware of, and we tried to make some sort of provisions in the catacombs, that when the war was nearing the end, that we would disappear, because I was pretty sure the Germans would come with machine guns or whatever, and wipe us out. And it was that they had a census once, in a huge field, as well documented, I think. And the whole town was there. And they were standing in rows and counting 1, 2, 3, 4. Of course, they got the number wrong, so it started again. And then there was a little bit of disturbance, and when they came out with violence and machine guns and God knows what. And I was pretty sure then that the day has come. And in fact, some of us were prepared to charge them if that happened, in the hope that we could take some of them with us. And when I finally went to Auschwitz, of course I didn't go till October 44 from Auschwitz. I got off the train. First of all, I was in the train. Mostly ill people. I was the one that was the fittest. spent my whole time in the journey to Auschwitz, which took 7 days, in a rotary. For several reasons. A, I could get a few minutes sleep, I just said, I don't want to be disturbed. B, I made sure that it was kept clean, that there was no infection. And I used it as a sort of my command. I mean, look, I was only a kid of 15, 16. And I tried to explain what I think was going to happen, but they are that. Not going to be nice. As soon as I got, I was the first one to get off. And the Polish prisoner, who the receiving committee, just as I used to be in Terezin, said gas. Well, it was the only thing he said to me. And then we were herded into columns. Of course, all our luggage stayed on the train. We didn't want to take anything with us. Now, having been prepared for something like that, I had 3 shirts, 2 pairs of trousers, boots up to my knees, with an pair of socks inside, and 3 overcoats. Only.
Wearing them.
Wearing. So though I wasn't very tall, I looked like a mountain. And my mother was also properly equipped. But the men and women, of course, separated. And he walked in the file to the end where I was assessed by doing that.
To the right or the left?
To the right or left. And I realized most people were going right. And that virtually all the women were going right. And I went to one of the guys who seemed to be responsible for this whole setup. He wasn't an Oberstuhl by fear, but I called him that because I like to be flattered. And I asked permission to go with my mother to look after her. And he took one look at me and said, no. And he sent me away, back to the left-hand column. And that was, of course, the column of the fit. And the other thing that I learned was that one of the prisoners whispered to me that I'm 18. I was barely 16. So when I came to the end, I was asked, be out? And I said, 18 and a half. And we were actually in Auschwitz-Birkenau, and then we went to the Lager, and I think we were given about one blanket between six or something like that. Really sick. And by this time, of course, we had been, all our clothes had been removed. I realized again, see, the trick was never to be at the front and never to be at the back, so that you could see what was happening in front of you and adjust to it, but not be exposed from behind. And it was a huge long column, and we were told to undress, but keep our boots on. And anybody who had knee-high boots, they were taken away because the Germans wanted to. Well, I happened to have knee-high boots. I also still had a knife. So I cut them down without being seen. And furthermore, I had the presence of mind picking up some dirt and getting the edges back, because those who cut their boots down and were caught most awful hiding. So there I was in my own boots, cut down somewhat so that they didn't get confiscated. And we, of course, went through the disinfection and the shaving and all that. And then we finished up in the barracks. And again, it was a trick that we had learned when we had to stay out overnight. So we managed to get the blankets, another blanket underneath us, and I rolled the people in like sausages. And we were, in fact, reasonably warm overnight, whereas other people seemed to be freezing. And then we went, were herded out, and we saw the black smoke coming out of the crematorium. Told that that's where my mother was. Again, through one of the working prisoners. But you had to know who was who, how to ask, without actually looking at them, moving your lips as little as possible. So by this time I knew that we might finish up there as well, because we kept us for about 3 or 4 minutes, I can't remember exactly. And then we were headed for the lorries and taken to prison. And stayed there till, I think, the 18th of January.
So it was
then the Russian invasion got too near. We got bombed, and but up to the last day, there was building what looked like a crematorium, an extermination chamber, at Fürstenfeld. The mentality of the people, unbelievable. I mean, they had plainly lost the war, certainly on the Eastern Front. And nevertheless, they were building structures of extermination, of concentrating on saving their name or their country. And of course, in the mine, I worked with Poles and Russians, civilian Poles, who were fifth class Germans, as they called them. You know, all the Silesian area, there's nobody's really pure there. Some are German, some are Poles, some are Moravians, some are Czechs, some were Slovaks, some were God knows what. Couldn't trust anybody. Everybody was afraid of everybody else. And I worked with a Polish miner. I was his laborer. But again, going with a fairly unpleasant fellow on the surface, he would bring me every night, work nights, as a night shift, every night, a large piece of thick, black, Polish homemade bread with some sort of lard, fat in it. I'll get a drink of his vodka. Okay, a coffee flask, full, not coffee, full of vodka. So I had my guts sterilized. The camp was full of people dying of awful sorts of dysentery and so on. Nothing. The only thing I had was sinusitis. And very badly. And the German doctor, for reasons best known to himself, pushed up my sinuses. Presumably so that I could go and work. But knowing the organization, working with it, learning a few words of Polish, so if I could swear back at this chap. And because we were primarily involved in laying rails, which was a bit more essential than just digging coal, because you can deliver it without rails. So he had a privileged position, and through that I had a privileged. When you came down the cage, you disappeared in various directions. And we were, because we were laying rails, always at the furthest end. Either laying new ones or taking old ones down, transferring them somewhere else. So I would be the last, or one of the last, to arrive at the cage on the way up. But this guy would always take me there, the miners, the Polish miners, and they're coming. Some of them just before the cage. And I would be taken where I'd not be talking about various things. But of course, by then I could understand and check and Polish isn't so dissimilar once you get it into your ear. So I learned what was happening in the outside world. I'm not so sure that some of the remarks that were passed so that I did hear them and could pass them on. Where they pretended that they were our enemies because they had to pretend to be German orientated. They couldn't be trusted. But I think, in spite of rubbing out the anti-Semitism, that there was quite an intention to help, but within very confined limits. And then we would march back to the camp. The only trouble with that mine was it was only 70 meters deep. And black coal, which is black coal, is much deeper. And a nice lake above it had a tendency to empty itself into the mine. So that you came to the surface, soaked. In midwinter. So if you stood on parade being counted before you went away, you couldn't move because your clothes were frozen. So you had to devise tricks to move while responding to attention so that you could actually walk away and march back. And the mine next door was operated by Russian prisoners of war. So we had some contact with those as well, and I knew through them, obviously. And we had some plans of escaping east with the Russians. But then, of course, they headed us all off into coal tracks and took us on a little journey of Europe. It took us 2 days, I think, to walk to Gliwice, Swai, as they call it. And we spent the night in a hay barn, at least I was in a hay barn, most of the person was outside. And again, because of the contacts with the command, I knew roughly where we were going, roughly when we were going. I could get some bread to take with me, because there's no food on the way. They said that we were in the kitchen. But when we were overnight, we managed to come and get some food from the peasant to got something to eat, not much. And then we were herded into these wagons without any food or anything, open, and taken down through Moravia to Austria, right across Austria, and up through Germany to Mauthausen. That took 10 days. When we were going through Moravia, the train stopped, fortunately for me, stopped within throwing distance of a bridge. And some people threw us through before the Germans started shooting them.